Kneel before me. Lay your sword at my feet. Pledge me your service and you'll rise again as John Stark, Lord of Winterfell.
I wonder, who could all these fine people be?
A man wonders.
I suppose we should allow all of you inside. Welcome.
There's no one here by the name that you're looking for.
A podcast has no name.
Actually, it does, and the name is Game of Bones.
We're glad to welcome you all to the show this week. We've just come off the viewing of the second episode of Season 5, and it's winged exit, and the world is in chaos. I think that it's all safe to say that none of us were expecting the way that it finished.
I was not expecting any of that of this entire episode. It felt all new to me. I don't think there's a single thread that of like characters where I was like, oh, they'll be doing this. Like even the Brienne and Pod stuff, I expected them to be like on their way, but no, that was some interesting, very interesting stuff. This whole episode was extremely exciting and took the show in directions that I had no clue it was going. So super happy about that.
I think, Eric, things might be a bit new to you.
Did you say Eric?
Yes.
my Britishness is rubbing off on you.
Exactly. I was going to say, you are not listening, or listening, you are not watching this week's episode in your normal location.
That's right. I'm actually broadcasting this podcast in the same area where I watched it, and that is a room above a pub in southeast sector 17 of London, and sector is my word for it. It's actually just like a district or a zone or something. But
are you there visiting? Yes. Cormoran Strike's office for a case.
Cormoran Strike's office is, did you know they happen to be David Heyman's office back when he was when he was auditioning people for the film
on Denmark Street back in the day?
You know what, I'm gonna go there tomorrow. That's what I'm gonna do with my day tomorrow, and I'm gonna have Doombar. I haven't had Doombar yet.
You gonna have lunch with him?
No.
He with Cormoran Strike?
David Heyman.
If you could have lunch with your favorite fictional characters. But I'm actually in London. I came here for a Harry Potter convention that MuggleNet threw. It was a one-day expo called Expo Patronum. And that was a really highly successful event. We saw Natalia Tena was there, and so was Warwick Davis, Alfie Allen, and a number, or not Alfie, oh shit, not Alfie Allen. If Alfie Allen was there, I would probably still be hanging out with him.
Right.
I would not be on this podcast, and you all would understand, because as listeners who know me know that, anyway, Alfie, Enon.
He's got there. Theon on the brain.
Yeah, Theon on my mind. But no, guys, it was a wonderful experience, but watching this episode tonight on Sunday has been another, like, highlight. Absolutely, 100%. I was blown away. This episode, like, I liked last week's episode, but this episode is like so much crazier.
Well, I mean,
if that makes sense.
Yeah.
They try and do that as the episodes go on. Build up your level of excitement.
Cut out the fact that Drogon returns to Dany. Cut out the fact that Dany executes one of her own, and that Jon is elected 998th commander to the Night's Watch, and you've still got a badass chase sequence with Brienne on horseback, really pulling her weight for the first time ever. She does not have a good track record, and that gets thrown in her face by Sansa, of all people. Sansa, I'm so sorry. But that chase. And so this episode had plenty of, tons of stuff. I cannot wait to get into it with y'all.
Eric just summed it all up, so we're done.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. We'll be back.
Bye, everybody.
With our second episode.
Don't let the door hit you.
You got
on the way
this
out.
Shot that you've been wishing for the longest time, which is Arya arriving in Braavos with the great Titan.
You did foretell. Both you in did front foretell of her. this thing. You're like, man, I wish that was the first time we saw Braavos. Doesn't matter that it wasn't the first time we saw Braavos. That was a badass shot, and I'm glad that it happened.
Yes. So we do get introduced, or reintroduced, I should say, to Braavos with a bit of history to the Titan, because of course in last season when Stannis and Davos head there, there isn't a nice little ferryman who is helping both of them on their way and giving them a little bit of backstory into the city and it and its history. And I would actually say we got to see the Titan quite a few times, because if you noticed, he's in the background as Arya and the Bravosi men are approaching the House of Black and White.
I did notice that. So now I know where the House of Black and White is in relation to the Titan of Braavos and the entrance to the city.
It actually made me think of when we were looking at those maps when we were recording stuff for Patreon months back, and how the House of Black and White is strategically placed. I don't think that they geographically captured it perfectly, but I think that, you know, the idea of it being a place that they needed a row to that was set apart from kind of the metropolistic area of Braavos was, it was cool that they did it that way. And I liked how some of the shots outside of the house in black and white were able to have the Titan sort of foreboding in the background.
Yeah.
The captain set it up. He said, whenever Bravo stood in danger, the Titan would step with fire in his eyes. He would wade into the sea and smash his enemies.
Do you guys think that's true?
Well, whenever we reach some place, you know.
He's a statue, Eric. Didn't you hear what Arya said?
Well, you've seen, look, you've seen Deathly Hallows Part 2, okay? A little bit of transfiguration and the statues come coming at you.
When White Walkers happen, when a baby can be transformed into a thing, when fireballs are thrown from hands, I feel like anything's possible. So whenever the story reaches its fateful conclusion, or wherever we're nearing whatever zenith that we actually end up nearing as the books and the shows progress, how excellent would it be if the Titan stepped with fire in his eyes and joined the fray?
As soon as the captain
said
that, it's just like, hey, that is going to happen. That's like that. Okay, now that you've said that, that's going to happen. It's just like old Nan's stories, right? It's like all of them have come true. So that's totally, I'm committed now to seeing that before the series is over.
Yeah, I think that it was done extremely well when, as soon as Arya mentioned that it was a statue, there was that really loud noise.
She reaches for her sword. Like,
it's very, very timely, of course, that it would happen as soon as she made that comment. So you have to wonder, maybe there is, given the fact that we are in Braavos and we are in Essos.
It's just a horn, right? Or did the statue actually like bellow at her?
Hey, it's open to interpretation.
You're right, though. We are in Essos. We, you know, like I said, everything's on the table. I'm not here to discount theories or wild ideas, because at the end of the day, it just comes down to whatever is cool in a story, whatever, you know, drives the plot forward and makes a lot of sense. How amazing would it be to see the Drogon that we saw tonight, larger, more deadly, and with his brothers circling a Titan in some sort of final battle? That would be insane.
It would be pretty epic.
I mean,
or the Titan fighting the dragon. So cool. I mean, come on.
Exactly. That's what I'm
Can
saying.
Can Bran warg into the Titan?
Oh, jeez. I don't know if it works that way, but we'll see.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. We're getting way too
now,
far
that would
ahead
be pretty
ourselves.
Awesome. Unless the Titan flies, I don't think that he will.
There was something like Snows can become Starks, but Starks can't become Stones. So there's
we canoed through Braavos. We got a nice little shot from inside of the sort of the drain gutter area, and just in general establishing the breadth, the culture, and the depth of the place that we're in. So I thought that that was
That's
done pretty well.
Definitely my new favorite shot of the series, I think, so far, is that storm gutter that they're in, like you just mentioned. Like, how do they think to do that? Because it's such a different type of shot. You just throw a camera in on a like a floaty or like a little boat nerd, or maybe you fix it.
Or you send a cameraman.
You send a cameraman
into
in that
area. It does well to, I mean, with relative ease, you know, bringing down the music and putting in some of the foley, like the water actually draining. You're bringing in more of that real life sound, and it does mechanic to pull the viewer sort of out of the context that they were in previously, which is this kind of epic, you know, shots of people meandering with foods and then pulling it into a very like raw sense of where they are, hearing that actual sound effect. So it was, I liked it.
That's one thing that I was going to say I really liked about going to Braavos in this episode is that you're completely removed from all that's going on back in Westeros, particularly in King's Landing or at the Wall, and even with Dany out in Meereen. There's so much conflict, so much battle going on, but yet here you are in Braavos, and you could even make the case for a bit later in the episode when you go to Dorne, and all is peaceful, and they're completely removed from what is going on in the rest of the world. That's not to say that they're not involved in some capacity, but these people are going about their daily lives as if there is no conflict, there is no strife. And it's nice to see that.
That's true. I mean, they're trading at the port, or, you know, harvesting or moving around some nuts, Arya notices. And, you know, there's probably some fruit and some nuts there that she's never had before. And it's just, it's interesting to see these people going about their daily lives. You're right. It's like, it's a time of peace. It's a town of, they're going about their daily business, and she's there to learn to kill people.
And the captain brings her to this monolithic house of black and white that we get to see so much. It's, I mean, foreboding.
Yeah.
Those four pillars, those two monochrome doors.
Well, it's so funny that the building is named for its aesthetic choices, because it's only got two of them, and it's that it's a big fucking building, and that the door is black and white, half black and half white. But maybe it has more to do with life and death. I don't know.
The light, the darkness.
Yes, absolutely. Representing the neutral aspect of the kinds of people that inhabit it. Obviously, we've learned so far that these people have no sense of self. It's a man thinks this or a man thinks that. And not to jump too far ahead, but toward the end of the episode, when the reveal to our past friend, Jack and Hagar, happens, which was very cool, we're not really clear that it's actually him. It could just be another faceless man choosing a face that is maybe available to all of them.
That's true. Wouldn't that be a twist if it was like him, but not?
Well, unlike the welcome that we gave to our listeners and allowed them in upon first knock into the house. Of
two knocks.
Game of Bones. Arya does not get so lucky. In fact, she gets denied hardcore by the man who answers the door. And she just decides that because she has nowhere else to go, she's going to chill out on the steps.
She has everywhere else to go.
Everywhere else to go.
Cersei, Walder Frey, the Mountain, Meryn Trant.
One day later, Cersei, Walder Frey. The Mountain, Meryn Trant. She, bless Arya, she only leaves to go find food.
Just a handful of creative shots using the front of the building. Just like, all right, we really need to stretch this space. This is where she is. We'll this is a great vertical point of view, and we'll pull her into the foreground. Or this angle with a nice little bend up and a nice little dolly into a bend.
I think it's very astute of her to recognize that it's a test, or that it appears to be a test. It's a test that she passes. I don't know if they were just waiting for her to behead a poor, poor pigeon before letting her into the house. That was like what the whole end game was. But her staying outside of it for at least, we can say, a night, you know, determinedly mentioning the names of the people that she wants to learn to kill, wants to kill one day, was not doing it. And it was only after she went and got some food that that man appears and obviously scares everybody else off and gets her in. But I don't know what kind of a test that was, because ultimately he went right into the teacher role and explained the fact that the man she's looking for does not in fact have the name that she thinks he does, or any name.
I just think it's beautiful to finally see Arya in a place like this. You know, she's been wearing the same outfit for a very long time. She's been traveling the same sort of road for a very long time with a handful of different companions. And it's been a long journey since the Sept of Baelor. And now she's finally in Braavos. And we've been waiting for this moment for a very, very long time. So for us as an audience, I felt like, and just judging by all the things that people have been saying, I feel like it's just a cathartic release to finally see her here in Braavos, and to see her stand with Needle, and to see her, I guess now she's formidable, scary. You know, she told the boys that wanted her sword, she was like, turn around and go. All of a sudden now she's hardened, you know, that kind of that look on her face when they were arriving. I feel like we're getting shown a very different Arya for a purpose.
It was very Stannis-like. I wanted to go back and watch the other episode to see if Stannis had the same facial expression when he was arriving in Braavos.
That's interesting. Yeah, no, that's a good point. Someone do that and be able to compare the faces side by side.
Eric, you mentioned the pigeon, and I couldn't help but think of that being a throwback to the Baelor episode when she killed the pigeon in King's Landing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, and they also mentioned pigeon pie, don't they, this episode, another wonderful scene that I'm sure we'll get to later. But
oh, gosh.
The
incredible.
Pigeon beheading, absolutely I wrote incredible. It's super incredible. Oh, Lawless. But, you know, this pigeon beheading, I could have done without. I mean, nice swipe. Yeah, Arya, good on you. Good on you.
It was a great swipe.
This is probably the decapitation that hurts me the most, though.
Well, let me just say that pigeons in metropolitan areas, they're more trusting of us humans. So if she would have been able to kill a wild bird, per se, I'd been a little bit more impressed.
Oh, there you go.
This one
You're
was
baiting
just
baiting her. That's a good idea.
So
you can do better, Arya.
You were mentioning the test, though, Eric. I think that the reason this faceless man approached the alleyway was, let's say that the test was happening and that it was all just random. And of course it was random. Like, those boys were clearly just hanging around the alleyway. They saw a girl with an easy to find sword and they're like, it's worth 100 pigeons, so we could just take it from her. There's a few of us and just one of her. But when she said, nothing's worth anything to dead men, he immediately appeared. Which I feel like that's almost a call sign to the kind of person that would be allowed into that building.
That's like a Dumbledore's not gone. Only as long as those here remain loyal to him, and then Fox shows up. It's like the calling of the. Tried to make a Harry Potter reference there, but yeah, super badass of that guy. I have a feeling he was following her ever since she left.
But he revealed himself after she revealed herself to be worthy.
Let's remember, she threw the coin into the water. And yet somehow he had it in his hand when he showed up there.
Well, they're great fishermen in Braavos.
That is true. So we go from Braavos to Westeros and are with our good friends Brienne and Pod, who have happened upon yet another inn.
Yet another inn.
And I have no trouble saying this, and I hope that you guys agree. And it's not really a negative. It's just more of my own feelings on it. But I was surprised at how quickly Pod and Brienne came upon Baelish and Sansa.
Why? They were together in the last episode, weren't they?
That's true, but I completely agree.
Together in what sense?
Well, you mean, we mentioned last week that the carriage passed.
But that's not sitting together.
No, I mean together in that, well, they're all in the same geographic, like it was established last week that they are, and if they're heading the same cardinal direction, it makes sense they would both stop at the same hop-in place.
Must be good food if it's crowded, right?
Yeah, I don't know. But that's what surprised me, though, too, is because this show loves its near misses, right?
Exactly.
Between characters that know each other. And so I wasn't expecting to see her again. Even though they were in the same geographic area, I'm like, okay, they're just going to go north or some crap. They actually find each other and get a second chance at the whole I was your mother's protector thing. And Brienne, I mentioned this, I think, probably before we were recording, but she doesn't have that good of a track record with protecting Starks or people in general, people that she's sworn to protect. And unfortunately, Sansa throws this in her face, but I don't know, there may be some redemption. Like, if we had to rate all of Brienne's interactions where she swears to protect somebody, this might have gone a little bit better than Arya's. What do you guys think?
I mean, it's tough to say. It was a failure on both sides, so really. Yeah. You just want to stay black and white with it. She didn't succeed.
But let's do that this whole episode. Let's just stay black and white.
Micah's point, though, the show has been really just George's writing in general has given us this sense of anxiety in the storytelling of these near misses. And I thought it was cleverly done in the last episode. It was a little in our face, but it was very cleverly done. Mm-hmm. I did not expect them to meet or to be in the same place. And I certainly did not expect Brienne to just walk up and start the conversation and kneel and get right down to the business. I feel like we've been conditioned so far in the show to expect something very different. So on one hand, it's neat that they're shaking it up. On the other hand, it's kind of a break from what we're used to seeing. And I don't think that it's a bad thing. I just think it felt different. I think that it's something that we should probably get used to as these seasons pace much closer to the very end, because there's only so long that these characters aren't going to be able to see one another. It's only so long, like the moment with Stannis and Jon, that we're not going to be able to feel such grand emotion when it comes to things. So
I agree.
Right.
I think it was a bit rushed from a pacing standpoint. Not that they were in the same physical location, but just to your point, how quickly Brienne stood up, walked over, knelt down next to Sansa, starts getting into it with Baelish, then blows out of there, kills a few people, takes off on their horses and, you know, eventually saves Pod's ass a little bit later on and kills a few more of House Aaron.
She prepped for it. She just told him to get the horses and the horse. We have one horse, my lady.
Littlefinger begins his sort of campaign of deconstruction. You can see it happen immediately. He references meeting her with Renly, saying her loyalty came free of charge. And now, obviously, she's been sort of paid well, I suppose, for her loyalty, which is a dig because you know that Baelish knows better.
Yeah.
He's constantly making looks back to Sansa. When she kneels and says that she was Lady Catelyn's sworn sword, Baelish says, "I've known her since she was a girl and she's never mentioned you." It's like, let's get real. Like, first off, Brienne clearly wasn't born when you've known her since she was a girl. And clearly you haven't been in contact with Catelyn because she's been with Robb doing things that the King of the North would do during wartime. The only time that you saw her was at the place that you met Brienne for the first time, and also she met Brienne for the first time. So this is clearly when you see someone playing dumb and using information at their advantage. That he's doing this to Sansa, but I feel like Sansa obviously knows better. You know? Like, obviously she knows
better. I hope. I mean, she still doesn't take Brienne on, which I think would be like the biggest thorn in Baelish's side. And I think what we're seeing here is Baelish, you know, having to think on his feet. Mm-hmm. You know, it's
agree
like
100%.
We know that people, what is it with like people walking up to people in pubs and introducing themselves, like the way Catelyn first captured Theon or Tyrion. So it's pretty funny that this happened this way. But I think, yeah, Baelish is just reacting. If his immediate thought is to call things out like her Lannister armor, just the way the Hound did, and try and turn her against Sansa. You know, I really do believe Sansa made her own decision here, even though I think it was the wrong one. But Baelish, it actually gives me hope that he's not as intelligent as we thought he was, because he's just, like, as you said, Zach, he just plays dumb, and he kind of gives shitty responses to why she's not a good knight or anything like that.
He was just trying hard. He was using a lot of qualifiers when I don't think that he needed to. Sansa is in a place surrounded by armed men with someone who is a lord, and clearly she's learned enough at this point to be silent when she needs to be silent and to speak when she needs to speak. She's coming into her own. I think that was established with her accepting the ale offer and then sort of asking Baelish leading questions like, does it give you courage? And you mentioned that the ale gives some men courage. Like, these are grown up questions, essentially. And it's different from the Sansa that was rescued and brought onto the boat. So
that's true.
I feel like we're getting staggered plot progression and character progression. And it just happened kind of quickly.
It's just it's very much a scene for me of the pot calling the kettle black, because Baelish is trying to throw more dirt in her face, and he mentions that people suspected it was her that killed Renly, and then he mentions that he's Sansa's uncle because he married her aunt right before her aunt's
my beloved
his beloved's untimely death, and I'm like, which you caused, bastard, and Sansa knows that. So it's like, you know, nothing is. I think he just disproved himself, because sometimes people have to die.
Yes and no, though. She like, that's them being on a team. Like, he's establishing that team perspective, not only by saying that we're family now, but by telling a false story about something that they both witnessed. It's like an end thing. You know what I mean? When if they're lying to someone for a certain reason, like if he's showing his innocence or showing his grandeur or the reason that he would be so untrustworthy right now by him telling this lie that they're both in on, I feel like it just strengthens their resolve a bit. And I think that some viewers may walk away from this thinking that Sansa is being befuddled or bewitched or just fooled in general by Baelish. But I don't think that that's the case. I think that when Brienne was speaking about before your mother died, and you know that sort of longer shot, if we go back and watch, where she's looking at Brienne and considering things, I don't think that she disregards this person wholly. I definitely think that when she mentioned kneeling in front of the king, she was upset, and I don't think that she trusts Brienne, but I think that that's just a mechanic of what she's been led to be trained with so far.
Brienne too is honest to a fault, and it's shown through in this particular scene when she was talking about how Renly was killed. And I think Baelish bringing up, well, and how exactly did he die? And she goes into a story about how a shadow with the face of Stannis Baratheon was responsible for it. it makes Brienne seem less credible.
Definitely,
and
yeah.
I think that's why Baelish was what he was getting at ultimately.
He led to it.
Was
yeah.
trying to paint her as somebody who was not only unreliable and unable, as was already mentioned, to protect both Renly and Catelyn, but somebody who's just creating these ridiculous stories that really have no basis in truth. Because let's face it, has Sansa ever seen anything that would suggest that
yet,
something
yeah.
the likes
no,
of a
Sansa has
shadow...
only seen the cold, hard, non-magical truths of the world. She's not seen ever since the death of her direwolf. She's not seen anything that I would characterize as being magical.
And how about the fact that she calls her Lady Sansa in a bar mm-hmm. with a bunch of people mm-hmm. around?
Well, I think yeah, Baelish is going to have to kill every fucking person in that whole bar.
He probably did.
That.
Do you think that he would have killed her
yes.
in Pod?
That's tough because I'm wondering what he's going to say to... Like, I'm wondering what the Sansa-Brienne relationship is going to be moving forward. Because will she just be like, oh, that woman got away. Oh, I admire her more. Or will that woman got away. Oh, I should look out for her. You know, like, I don't know where Sansa reads. It's, like, impossible to read Sansa. She's doing her best unreadable mm-hmm. mystery person.
Even us.
I wonder if, yeah, I wonder if Brienne's escape would actually help or hurt her Sansa's opinion of her.
Like us, Sansa saw the look that Baelish gave to the guards when he said, it's dangerous out there. Why don't you stay? He gives them a look as if to say, you know, seize them. But or sees her, but not aggressively. Essentially, she can't leave because she knows too much. So it's really strange. We can only use what we've learned of Sansa to this point. I hope that listeners don't and viewers don't forget the kind of person that she is and where she's come from as she's spending time with someone we know to be this diabolical madman that has mm-hmm. planned and orchestrated so much. Like, she's doing what she has to do in this case. And she's doing it well.
Are you saying, I feel like there was a bit of character moment at the end of last season where there's that one scene with her and Baelish after Lysa's death, or maybe it's before, where she basically, he comes to thank her for protecting him about the whole thing. And she really like resolves herself to following him. And it's very clear that it's because he's the devil she knows. Do you think that resolve has just like strengthened to the point where she's not accepting help from someone who's even, you know, actually competent in Brienne simply because there's that factor of doubt? And with Baelish, there's not that because she knows exactly what he wants, or so she thinks.
I think she's smart and she realizes the fact that Brienne was also at the wedding and she has had relations. That's probably not the best word. She has a relationship with Jaime Lannister, and I think she's very wary of anybody who she knows to have had some sort of relationship with the Lannisters to possibly take her and bring her back. Remember, she was thought to be complicit in Joffrey's murder with Tyrion, and remember Shae's testimony. And even without her testimony, I think Cersei would believe that Tyrion and Sansa conspired to kill Joffrey. So anybody who's coming from those parts, even though she may be claiming that she swore an oath to Catelyn, it's difficult for Sansa to trust in anybody. And I think for the time being, she trusts Littlefinger to an extent, but we're going to see that the only person she can really trust, as is the case with a lot of these characters, is herself. And there was one thing I wanted to bring up that happened in the conversation between Sansa and Baelish prior to Brienne interrupting, and that was the mention of a marriage proposal being mm-hmm. accepted.
Yeah.
And Sansa immediately assumes that it's Baelish's that's been accepted, but I'm not so sure I believe that.
I wouldn't have caught that. I would not have caught that had you not pointed that out, that it might not be his.
He's there picking the bones out of his food, and he's so... or content with what's happening. Yeah, it's not likely that he's being remarried. He's the Lord of the Vale, and unless he's got another eye on another piece of land, I don't think that he's going to pull the same ruse twice so close in succession to one another. So,
but does he care about Sansa enough to marry her to someone actually good, or is it more of a territory? Is he just using her like a pawn, like a puppet, like he uses so many others? Just to get more stuff for him. Like, to what extent? He rescued
Absolutely.
Her from the capital. But which is it? Like, he rescued her from the capital. So was that for his own gain, or was that genuinely out of a love and a want for revenge for Catelyn?
It's a tough call. I don't think it was a want for revenge for Catelyn. I don't think that he has that kind of passion inside of him, unless he really did truly love her, which again, I don't know what having Peter Baelish's love would mean for something like yeah. retribution.
And then there was one other thing kind of in this sequence towards the end when Pod was talking to Brienne after she had cut down a bunch of men from House Arryn, and Pod posed the question, and I thought it was Pod. What an amazing job by him here, you know, really sort of the thinker, despite all that's happened around him. He asks her if Arya and Sansa have refused her services, does it make her released from her vows?
It should. I think a less stubborn person would see it that way, but she's Brienne, and her plan, as she tells Pod, to follow them is brave in a way because, you know, she knows they have more men than just... and that they have no men, but I think it's pretty stupid because Sansa very clearly doesn't want her help. And I don't think that anyone in this world is lucky enough anymore that to have someone like Brienne at your side when she's needed most.
I think at the end of the day, Sansa, it's less about her relationship with Baelish, the ins and outs of their interior relationship that's keeping her away from Brienne. I mean, just look around. Look at what technically is there, what's available. Brienne appeared to be alone with stories about a shadow-faced thing, a shadow with a face. It's just, you know, using sheer numbers and tactics. Like, she's been in the capital for so long. Why would she leave the sort of comfortable situation that she's in? And I don't think that necessarily releases Brienne from her vow. I mean, just... Brienne sees what Sansa's doing. She sees the position that she's in. Brienne's been to the capital. Brienne's been through the ringer in her adventure thus far. And I think it's clear that she's going to stop at nothing to try and take someone out of a situation. Because at the end of the day, Sansa was literally in front of Baelish when she said all those things. And we know that Sansa knows how to dig in to say the right things that feel wrong. She knows how to cut deep when it's time to cut deep. It's the same when Tyrion was dismissing Shay. Like, the things that he said, he didn't necessarily believe, but he knew that he could use them as facts because those facts were there. So she could use those facts against Brienne to try to throw her off the scent, essentially, because Sansa knows how intent Baelish is on his own plan, and this interruption would only lead to the death of someone that swore their sword to her dead mother. So I just feel like... I don't know. We're in a strange situation because they both know more than they want to say out loud. And in Brienne's case and in Podrick's case, I don't think that they want to give up. Podrick is probably just trying to help Brienne out in the situation. Obviously, he'll follow her to heaven and hell if he needs to.
Such a loyal squire.
Curious horse rider. When just yelling, stop, stop. Like, there was a bit of humor.
I will say this, though. That boy wanted some ale bad.
He did, right? She was like, more ale. And he, the literally the brightest, most sincere smile I've ever seen in my
Hashtag life. Hashtag pod smile.
Wonderfully played. The end of circumstance, the end of whatever name we want to give it, does not fail us again. I was kind of disappointed not to see other familiar faces, but I don't know. A lot happened, and that sequence is something that we'll obviously touch on more in our follow-up episode this week. But it was a lot of things moving all at once and very, very early in this episode.
Very early.
And good chance that we know where they're headed.
Right.
We'll know where Baelish ultimately...
We think we do.
Well, Brienne sees her moving forward, sees them riding quickly away on the high road, which they're heading north and they're in a specific direction. And I think it has a lot to do with everything that we've spoke about so far. So without leading too much into that, I think all of you listening at home can draw your own conclusions there.
In addition to being introduced to Braavos in this episode, in a way I guess we hadn't before because we just went to the Iron Bank, we were also introduced to Dorne. And I think that it was set up well by the scenes between Cersei and Jaime a little bit before that, and them talking about Myrcella and them not being comfortable with the fact that Myrcella is in Dorne, surrounded essentially by a bunch of vipers who would like nothing better than to see the Lannister family destroyed. And what better way to get to Cersei than through her daughter? And there was that scene with the snake that was sent to Cersei along with the pendant that there are only two of in the world. Cersei has one, Myrcella has the other, and it was a clear threat. From who directly, I don't think we know, but I'm guessing we can make some assumptions here.
Well, I feel like when we finally, or when we do get to Dorne, there's somebody who's clenching their fists, and I feel like that is like a dead giveaway almost about who the culprit in Dorne might be.
Well, just judging by what she said, definitely.
Yeah.
And this is the same token that we saw at the end of the season that was kind of setting up this storyline that, or the end of the last season, that kind of that viper present in that curious box without a note, without any kind of wording, but you know, that says so much, obviously.
No, the Cersei and Jaime thing, it's super charged with emotion, and I'm kind of tired of Cersei cutting on Jaime, making cuts, but he's ultimately just there to protect her and do what's right by both of them. So I felt it's one of the stronger scenes. It is a goodbye scene, which they've had before, I think. So there's that. But it's he's got to do what he has to do. And it's odd now that she'll be left alone.
It seems to me, though, that she puts a lot of blame on his shoulders. And clearly she still thinks Tyrion responsible for Joffrey's death. But part of me can't help but think that she also blames Jaime in a way for not being able to protect their children, which he has a big issue with.
Not so loud.
That being said out loud. Yeah, okay. Exactly. And she mentions Joffrey's death. She mentions Myrcella being in Dorne and, of course, Tommen now on the throne. And I think it finally hits a chord with Jaime to say, well, I need to do something. So I'm going to go to Dorne. I'm going to find our daughter. I'm going to bring her back no matter what it takes. And I'm not going to ask Prince Doran. I'm going to tell him, more or less, is what he said. I'm paraphrasing a bit there. Or maybe he's not even going to tell him. Maybe he's just going to take her and that's going to be the end of it.
Cersei in this scene, very curious. You know, obviously upset. I will burn their cities to the ground if they touch her. That says a lot. When Jaime offered to go to Dorne, she was sort of smirking in disbelief, but Jaime just wants to please her. He wants to make up for all of these wrongs and to in her place where their rapport and their relationship is less charged with all this negativity. And as her father and as a father that has never been able to be there, I suppose that he sees this as his way for making up for a lot of that and some kind of karmic retribution. And I feel like even though Cersei seems like she thinks it's a bad idea when he mentions that he doesn't really know where she is, she just sort of casually goes, well, Oberyn mentioned the Water Gardens, you know, like, okay, well, there's a little information there. Thank you for that information. I guess you kind of do want me to go. And then she, you know, I kind of feel like she feels satisfied in that case that he's putting himself in danger to and moving forward with this plan. And allows another dig and says one-armed man or a one-handed man who really can't defend himself is going alone. And that's where he obviously says, never said I was going alone. And that's such a great
where
cut.
Where we see Bronn and his fucking castle and his wife, or wife-to-be, or castle-to-be, really. That scene, that estate, I want to know where that is in real life because I'd love to vacation there. That was just very oddly peaceful. And I don't feel like Bronn is quite tired of that lifestyle just yet. I feel like he's still kind of enjoying those strolls along the water. He is obviously a swordsman through and through. It's probably why he says yes, although of course Jaime gives him good incentive to leave. But I genuinely think that he is very, very happy where he is right now. And he's dressed well. He's got this thing. He's got the future's looking up for Bronn.
We see a very content Bronn, you know? I feel like with all the trouble that he's been through, the Battle of Blackwater and his best friend going on trial, it feels nice to walk along the beach with a girl that adores music, hates flutes, wants pigeon pies, and wants nothing more than to marry.
Definitely no flutes.
Our beautiful, wonderful man. He calls her dear, I think, some kind of loving pet
term
name, some kind of term. Yeah, there we go, term of endearment. And he stares up at a state castle, Stokeworth. He's like, I never thought I'd end up settling down in a place like this. And he just can't help but to feel a little bit of solace in the story for this one casual stroll, skipping stones across the water.
good, sweet Lawless, who had a lot happen to her back in season two. I think we all remember that scene.
We do.
Where Sansa was saved by the Hound. Lawless was not as lucky. But I think we saw a bit of the sellsword Bronn at one point when Lawless was talking about her sister and how that that whole inheritance...
not going to go as you planned.
Yeah, I think Bronn may have been...
showing his hand.
Planning for the future a bit.
Yeah.
Once he heard the story of Lawless's sister and the fact that she would inherit all of this first. Never know what that man would go to in order to secure his own well-being.
Well, he planted the seeds for it. I think he handled it really tenderly, right? He was just like, oh, bad people get what they deserve. It all comes around.
Mm-hmm.
He's just
Well, that I, line, it all comes around, I think, so was a little bit of a hint, shall we say. But it doesn't matter at the end of the day, does it? Because Lawless is not going to be his, nor is House Stokeworth.
Right.
So he's going on adventure.
Can I just say, though, a girl that's still at their age, and she's even the elder sister, still pulls her hair when mother's not looking? It's just like, come on. So yeah, Bronn's not too far off the mark here. I've been all over the world, and if there's one thing I've learned, it's meanness comes around. I thought that was very astute and kind of like a nice little comedic way to give us more lessons in the middle of the storytelling, which the writers have done a really great job of integrating.
Lawless, I'm sad to say, even if her sister were to turn up dead, I don't think that she would ever suspect poor old Bronn, old new hubby, new heir Bronn.
Especially with such fantastic friends as he had. She's like, well, who is that? And it's Jamie fucking Lannister.
Hiding in the grass. It's like a wild Jamie appears. He's there. He knows what he wants. He wants Bronn to come with him.
Well, I want his jerkin. It was very fashionable, very studly.
I was
very jealous. The costume department on the show stepping their game up with a nice soft Lannister burgundy/red. It was beautiful. Lawless was quite starstruck in the moment, I believe, especially when Jaime kissed her hand. We had a nice greeting. So Jaime, so Bronn of the Blackwater. It was just, it felt good. You know, it feels good to get those moments with these characters that we enjoy so much.
Yeah, it was a reunion of sorts, right? At least in so much as Bronn was best buds with Tyrion for such a long period of time. And now he's going on an adventure with Tyrion's brother, Jaime. So be interesting to see how those two travel together, knowing the great fun and spin-off sitcoms we could have had with Bronn and Tyrion. I don't know it'll be as good, but I'm sure there's going to be some interesting situations that the two of them get into. So, and by the way, Bronn is going to be getting a much better girl and a much better castle.
Yeah, I guess
all
he's
of this.
Temporarily a bachelor right now because Lawless is promised to another.
Oh, Sir Willis Bracken, maybe your plots will lead you to inheriting Castle Stokeworth yourself. We'll see. But Bronn is out of the picture, and they're heading as far south as south goes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what does that mean? I mean, I know I've seen the map, but it just, I wonder what prevents there from being more south. Maybe it's just
technology.
Water. There's nothing beyond the water. I mean, it's not as narrow as the Narrow Sea, but really there's nothing down there.
So coincidentally, in the next scene, we go as far south as south can go.
Wow, that's a nice transition there, Thrones team. But no, I'm finally, we saw Dorne, a little bit of it anyway, and we also saw the Water Gardens, which turns out that's exactly where Myrcella is. And
literally there, in the Water
literally
Gardens.
Literally there, as they speak, or as Duran speaks to Ilaria. But I feel like with the clenching of Ilaria's fists and her resentment, which she makes quite clear, there is going to be political dissent in Dorne. And I'm wondering, guys, did you feel like Doran's life may be in danger at the hands of his own people?
You think?
It made me reach a moment when I was watching the show, and I'm not proud of this, but I kind of just looked around and was like, is this Did we really need to be this upfront about it? When he says, we do not mutilate little girls for vengeance, not here, not while I rule. And she goes, and how long will that be?
Yeah.
Storms
her off. Parting threat. She's very, that's a little on the nose.
Which, can you imagine somebody of Ilaria's standing, which obviously is much different in Dorne.
Right.
Imagine if she did that in King's Landing.
Oh, I mean,
she's a nobody.
Right.
She's only Tyrion not from can get away with a royal family.
Yeah.
Well, Tyrion's Lord Tyrion. You know, it's a bit different.
Yeah.
It's Tywin Lannister's son. So,
but I wonder how much of that is true. I mean, here's the thing: his own men, his one protector guy, who's guarding and doesn't immediately let Ilaria in. He's guarding Durrhon, and he hears this. And it's important, I think, that this show and real life has shown you should probably look strong, you know, in front of your protectors, lest they think you're weak and go for the other guy. But he allows Ilaria to say that and walk out alive. And I'm wondering if that means he's actually a weak ruler, which is all she's trying to say.
Well, I definitely think that it was, like Micah said, this is a different place. And the fact that she was able to get away with that, it either has to do, I don't know enough about Dorne's geopolitical landscape to say that they're more or less flexible. I know that from what Bronn said that they're pretty hardened folk, and I know just from what we've seen so far that these are fairly hardened folk. So I would like to say that it's either her relationship that Prince Doran mentions with Oberyn that gives her such a strong place in his heart from now until whenever, or it's because of the kind of person he is and the kind of ruler that he is. And if the Dornish people are as for going to total war as she says, as sort of their mouthpiece, then, I mean, there could be some kind of revolt. But I feel like his point, Oberyn being slain during a trial by combat, is completely sound. If this would have been an all-out murder, then it would have been completely different. But at the end of the day, the Dornish weren't there, except the representatives, weren't there to see the fact that Oberyn was kind of showboating and he technically could have won the fight and everything would have been fine otherwise. And I feel like if she is the loudest mouthpiece coming back home and reporting what happened, especially to the Sand Snakes that she mentioned, who have this vast amount
that's
of love
true.
For their people, then I feel like she's probably sewing a story that's not quite 100% accurate. And that's, you know what I mean? That tells a much different, more aggressive spin on the tale.
If she were honest with herself and others, yeah, you're right. She would have even less of a case for going up there, for getting angry about it.
I understand why she's upset, though. I mean, it sucks. It was horrible. And the way he died and the way that the Lannisters were so happy about it and how they were... The history that they have already with their family, not to mention adding insult to injury, the prince's brother being killed the way that he was killed by the person that did those bad things in the past. It's all horrible. It's just not good for the situation.
It's all very dramatic.
Exactly. And I feel like the Dornish, they definitely have a podium to stand on in this. But what Prince Doran says, if all of the other people in Dorne were the people that made those decisions, then it's a good thing that all of those people don't make these decisions for the kingdom, right? That it's good that he's the one that's able to kind of oversee everything and to make the best decision, which is, by law, that is not a murder. He's been my brother long before he was anything to you, and this is the country that I rule, and this is the kind of country that we'll be. We will not cut her fingers off and mail them to Cersei one finger at a time. We're a different kind of people than that. Whereas we have, I guess, another sect of the population that's wanting to rise up into some kind of dissent and chaos. It's just interesting.
It's not unusual that there would be a call for vengeance. It opens old wounds, certainly for many in Dorne, because of what happened to Elia.
Mm-hmm.
And now Oberyn has died effectively at the hands of the Lannisters.
Mm-hmm.
It's Cersei's champion.
The same guy
who's defending Tyrion. Yeah, and the same guy who is responsible for the deaths of Elia and her children. And so don't think at the end of the day, though, that somebody the likes of Doran Martell is not planning in his own right or hasn't been planning for some time in his own right to get back at the Lannisters or to those who he feels is ultimately responsible for what has happened. Ilaria, actually, and I'm sure we're going to see a lot of stories about this, particularly this week, it took the place of a character Arianne Martell, who is a point of view character in the books.
Ooh.
And she's the niece of Oberyn, and she seems to be taking on this role that works because we know Ilaria. She was there in King's Landing when Oberyn was killed, and I think that it serves the right purpose for the show, but it's going to be one of those discrepancies I think a lot of people will have issue with, particularly because Arianne is a beloved book character. So we learn about this, I'm sure, a little bit later on as we do our readings, but it's just something to throw out there. But I'm excited that we are actually now in Dorne.
Finally.
We see Myrcella, and she appears to be fine, at least for the time being.
You are my
queen. She appears to enjoy... Yeah, that guy, the boy who's with her, calls her his queen.
Tristan.
In the garden. So, no, I love the Water Gardens, and ever since seeing that Day in the Life...
Would you like to play in the Water
documentary,
Gardens?
Documentary. I feel like...
I would.
I was looking forward to seeing it on screen, and it looks great on the screen. But I think to Ilaria and Doran's conversation regarding Myrcella, actually seeing Myrcella bounce up and down, you know, as she skips or whatever in the garden with this boy, I can understand how somebody like Ilaria would take it as an insult, considering what the Lannisters have done to their family just in the past. But currently, I mean, there's no beef with Myrcella. Myrcella herself is innocent, has done nothing wrong. And really, Doran's adamance about not harming her, about not shipping her back to her mom in little boxes or whatever it is that she said she wanted to do, is very reminiscent of Oberyn. When he told Cersei that they do not harm little girls in Dorne, he was merely speaking what ended up being his brother's code. And his brother's code is the same, and that's how they're linked. And I think, you know, again, talking about Doran's vulnerability here, I think that he's going to be the character that we're meant to like, not Ilaria, which actually says a lot, considering, Mike, as you said, Ilaria's replacement, or the character who she replaces, is apparently well-loved.
That's interesting. I mean, it makes sense that the way that they're writing this, that Ilaria would sort of pivot from the happy-go-lucky person that she was before if she lost the man that she loved, and sort of become this mouthpiece for this reign that, or for this plight that should take place. But Prince Doran does remind me so much of his brother, and I like his character. I feel like I want to see more of this guy, and I wish I would have seen him, you know, walk around some and do a little bit more than sit. But it was a little taste of Doran. Nice.
Well,
to
he's
see.
Stricken by gout,
which was something I was curious to see how they captured. But I felt like it's even just a more bit of a dramatic turn on that. Like, well, he hasn't. Like, we don't know how the show is adapting that injury, or if they will at all. And I know that's kind of a weird thing to look forward to, but we know from our reading those things about him, and I kind of just wanted to see how that was adapted. So
I think he's in a wheelchair. He's in a chair with wheels, I think. I think he's in a chair with wheels, and that may mean he can't walk. But I do look forward to seeing it. It's just sad because I feel like they're introducing, you know, Prince Doran, who's he's now, Mike, is he? He is the one ruler in Dorne right now. He's a prince, but they haven't made him a king. There's nobody above
him. We don't want to go calling people kings because that might piss off Cersei and...
Oh, yeah. Okay.
The Lannisters.
That's a good point. All right, because what I wanted to say was I hope they're not introducing us to another leader of a bunch of people who's going to die. Because that... And at least if they do, I hope he lasts longer than his brother did in one season, but...
It can't be the Seven Kings without Dorne.
It wouldn't be the Seven Kings of that Dorne, you know, until they return to the fold. I just hope I have high hopes for Dorne. I hope he squashes. I hope he's seasoned enough to squash more peacefully the revolt that is no doubt being waged by Ilaria and possibly Oberyn's daughters, the Sand Snakes.
Well, I think it'd be interesting to see this revolt, though. So there's that. So as a viewer, who's not in immediate harm,
just recalling something from a preview. That makes me a little bit unsettled we saw in the trailers. If you remember, there was a shot of the Sand Snakes surrounding somebody who was buried in the sand with a scorpion.
Yeah.
Looked a lot like our little friend, the guardsman.
Did it?
And he's not a very little man, to be honest with you.
Oh.
So while Myrcella appears to be safe for the time being, there is one son of the Harpy who is definitely not.
And this sequence was beautiful. I loved... I loved the casual meandering stroll through the alleyways of Marine with Dario and Grey Worm, someone that I've really grown warm to. Grey Worm, his grunting, his broken English. You know, it's just, at first I was just sort of like, okay, this is a new character. I'm not sure how long this person will stick around, but he's definitely sort of carved a place in my heart. And their camaraderie, you know, established, especially with this character at the beginning of last season with their dagger holding contest and who would walk beside the queen, is sort of heartwarming. And so seeing them grow even closer together while they're doing something so serious was a great spin on how they captured it with the show. And I think they're doing a great job with both of these characters as far as just establishing who they are while also pushing the plot forward. So them having some detective work and learning about blending in and whether or not the Second Sons are more adapted, it's just a really neat way to do something serious.
It was like Dario's trying to giving him advice on how to be what exactly, like how
more
to be
human.
A Second Son. More human.
You know, because he lost so much of his humanity growing up as an unsullied.
Yeah, that's true. You don't get any more of like a better punchline than him, that line about fear, really. I don't know. It is funny seeing those two together, though. Kind of, I don't know, not broing, but you know what it is. It's a relationship. It's a teaching moment for Dario. Dario's skill set increases every episode. Right now, he's a very personable guy who can find people hiding in very tight spaces. In fact, plastered into a wall,
he just busts through the wall.
There it is. I don't know that that's where I would have checked first, especially if I was unsure. There's a rug.
I would have checked the armchair. I would have poked the armchair and see.
Maybe there's an upstairs to that place. I don't know. But he was right, regardless. And I don't know how he was, but he was right that this guy was somehow enclosed in this wall. I don't know how he did that.
I mean, I think our listeners are probably queuing for us to discuss this on the show. Was the dagger throw and catch necessary for the stab? Right? That's the real question. Dario has much style.
May have been necessary for some people's zones. But this was another like entire subplot that wove its way through the episode and became just one of this episode's many big stories, big things that happened to our characters. But ultimately, we're in the situation where, not unlike Dorne, not unlike King's Landing, Dany's rule is being threatened. It's by the Sons of the Harpy, who we met last episode, and what that awful guy did to the poor Unsullied in the last episode. But we see the falling action from that. We see the repercussions of that and Dany's struggling with how to punish this guy, basically.
I like how you mentioned, Eric, that it kind of goes all throughout this episode, but we get a little bit of an idea of this character Mosador. I think I'm pronouncing his name right.
The
right?
Chief slave?
Yeah, exactly. Who is clearly a member on Dany's council. I thought it was really cool that we got at least a snapshot at what appears to be her version of the small council when they're discussing what to do with this son of the Harpy. It's clear to me that once he makes the statement that all they understand is blood, that he's not going to be in favor of the idea of a fair trial.
Right.
And there is, no pun intended, a lot of bad blood between the Sons of the Harpy and the slaves, or the former slaves, I should say. But what I really liked about this particular scene was the interaction between Barristan and Dany and how he's counseling her, telling her about her father, and how, you know, his way of ruling, this idea of inspiring fear into those that you're responsible for protecting, doesn't always have the end game that you want it to. And he really advocated for a fair trial for this person, and that is the direction that Dany decides to go in.
He has the perfect amount of sensitivity. He says, actually, Your Grace, here's the thing. Your father was actually fucking crazy in the nicest way possible. Like, in the absolute
best
way.
Those weren't lies your enemies told you.
She absolutely hears it, and the way that he says that it felt good to her father, that he felt right burning people alive, that he felt powerful, is possibly like is his attempt at guessing how she will feel sentencing this man to death. And it's just such a shame, of course, we're jumping ahead a little bit, but that choice becomes removed from her because she actually heeds his advice and decides to give this guy a trial. And I think that is a step in the right towards being the right Dany that is going to be a good leader of Westeros, because I've really begun, I think as of last season, to starting to question, I know we all have a little bit about how, you know, whether or not she would be a good ruler. And lately she's been very Mad Kingy in her extravagance in setting people in just basically giving people justice. She's doling out the justice and not doling out the mercy. And we've already heard her thoughts on it. I will answer injustice with justice. But I feel like Barristan's words were very wise. And in another situation, under other circumstances, it would have actually worked out in her favor.
This is just a disappointing story arc for them to be with in the first place. I would love for it to be a more hard-hitting than a dissenting group in the city that we've been in since last season. Like, not a dig at the plot of the show, but a dig at what's happening in Dany's world. That this is something that this is a group of rebels, essentially, that should just be rooted out and taken care of, not necessarily killed, but this should just be either not taken seriously, or if taken seriously, real action should be done. And I realize that real action, that they're trying to handle the situation. I realize that their action is taking place, but I feel like there are larger potatoes to fry in this situation. And I hope that the Sons of the Harpy aren't a season-long arc, because I said, at the end of the day, it's old slave owners in masks. They're people that, like this man said, they're people that have been hired by the great families to do their bidding. And Hisdar Zalorak doesn't know he's the head of a great family, and he's not aware of the situation, which leads me to believe that it's possible that he could be a member of the council that is also working in integration with those people that are dissenting, with how unhappy he is with the situation with the fighting pits. I think that it all might be...
He's full of shit, basically.
Right, if that's the case. If that's the case.
Oh, I trust him, but I'm very trusting. I'm a terrible judge of who's actually bullshitting Dany.
I agree with Zach, and I think the point is made very clearly at the end of the episode when the Son of the Harpy, just before he's about to go on trial, says to Mosador, "She doesn't belong here, and no matter how many of you traitors call her Misa, she will never be your mother." And I think it just speaks largely to what Dany has come up against in all these different cities that she's tried to overtake. The majority of people don't want her there, and the slaves that she's able to free, she's not able to take care of them, and they're not able to take care of themselves. So it's almost like it creates even more dissension than before she came there in the first place.
These people need one of their own to lead a city, to lead a kingdom, as one of their own would. I think it's easy for us to see these places in the East and kind of remove ourselves from the gravity of the situation. But essentially what it is Daenerys is conquering and ruling places that are greater than King's Landing, that are greater than the more civilized beacons of hope and security and that our characters have been in the midst of. Like, this is a big deal what she's doing.
There is. It's definitely a heavy sequence of events that takes place in this episode and those that have preceded it, especially as it relates to her storyline. I think that what she is ultimately trying to do is alter the course of history, you know, in so much as history will be told about these cities. You know, we learn in our own history about different cities that have been liberated, and that's exactly what she's trying to do. But she's not as experienced in the ways of ruling. And so I think that's coming back to bite her a little bit. And it does in this episode.
That's what these scenes with Dany are all about. The fact that she is not as experienced, and the fact that these Sons of the Harpy are the first real challenge she's had in terms of opposition that I can really think of. I mean, she's always overcome great obstacles in getting what she wants. She crossed the Red Waste. That wasn't supposed to be doable. She found her dragons and kicked the ass of the warlocks in the House of the Undying. She broke into Ask the Poor, set it a place ablaze. It's all good. It's all great. But now she's got these Sons of the Harpy, and she's really trying to figure out politically what her whole rule is going to be. She's creating law, and that gets mentioned in this episode, that the law is the law and she's not the law. No one person's the law. The law is the law. But she's making that stuff up as she goes. And this whole trial thing, it would have been interesting to see what the first trial under Daenerys as ruler would have actually looked like. I know it got taken from us, but you know, like I really respected Dany for giving in to Barristan's advice and also doing it like she thought it was the right thing and being interested in this. And honestly, even that, knowing that they take Mosador and put him to death among, amidst great, again, pleas for mercy and amidst great strife, it creates this huge situation. It's the right thing to do because ultimately people have to know that.
Is it?
Yes, because people have to realize that freedom does not mean freedom from consequences. And she's not being an oppressor here. She's, you know, being free comes at a cost. You should still respect the law. It's almost like, did she fail to explain that to people? Or is it them just doing whatever the hell they want to do? Because ultimately, there are former masters that are still alive. There are higher families that are still alive. And it's like the murder of the Unsullied aside, there was another murder committed, and it was against a man who was awaiting trial. And so it's just like, it's why you can't do those sorts of things.
It's a hard discussion to have, though, because a lot of those freed people just saw one of their own killed, and it aligns Dany in their eyes, or could potentially, with the Sons of the Harpy. So that, in and of itself, is another problem for her to contend with moving forward. The way they hissed at her.
This is what the Sons of the Harpy want.
You can't just do that, though, when you're not happy with a ruling. Like, I mean, they did. Obviously, they did.
They want to see this discord. They want to see the people that have been shouting her name and shouting mother toward her direction. They want to see them hissing. They want to see them questioning their leader. Because the great men in this city know that Daenerys isn't going to be here forever. They know that her end goal is to take Westeros and reclaim the throne that her family once kept. And this is all part of a way to either worm her out of here, push her away, or to make her react so strongly that the people that support her no longer. And if we saw the story from the perspective of one of these people that lived in Meereen, we would see Daenerys as someone who is coming in, a stranger, a non-native, conquering, and then establishing the rules that they'd like to see. Regarding the execution, though, it's a tough call because if she were to play politics in the situation, she would probably think against doing what she did in front of all of the people.
Yeah, that's the thing, though. I was going to say that. Why did it have to be a public display? She could have just killed him anyway.
She wanted to send a message, and there was no trial because he completely admitted to it. We could have made the argument that he also could go through a trial, but you know, he said that he liberated her from the decision, just like she freed them. He freed her from having to deal with the politics around it because he knows that she wanted to see him executed as for being a member of that group that's doing so much bad and killing people across the city. So it's all just a big circle of crap. It's chaos, and it's the wheel, and it's rough, and it's not easy. These are not easy decisions for Dany to be given. So it's kind of unfair for us to call her not a good ruler because she's not trying to rule a kingdom that is in a level state. She's trying to rule a kingdom that is filled with rebels and that are filled with different customs that she does not agree with. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out, but I'd like to see the Sons of the Harpy go away.
Yeah. I agree, and this has been a pretty intense conversation, so I think it's time we lighten things up a bit and go on the road with the eunuch and the imp,
because that was Valentis.
A great scene between the two of them.
There's a bug.
Throwing daggers at each other.
Yes, there's a bug.
Best be careful.
You might actually swallow some solid food.
Any scene that Tyrion is in is going to be good. Whether it's serious Tyrion or the one we tend to like more, which is sarcastic, humorous, playful Tyrion.
And he wants to go for a walk and Varys won't let him.
Well, Cersei's offering a lordship to those who bring her your head.
What was the line? What he refers to Cersei's...
He says she ought to offer her cunt best part of her for the best part of me.
Yeah.
He's very, 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 very jaded against her. And I mean, I feel like that comes from everything he's also saying in this scene that we know he's missing.
He's missing Shay.
Yeah.
He's dealing That's with true. The fact that he murdered his own father, murdered his lover who slept with his father.
Yeah, this is also a circle of shit, or this is after the circle of shit. This is after the wheel has been broken, and he's on the road with Varys.
So he's drinking away his miseries. Besides, what else is there to do for me inside this fucking box? Besides to drink and to woe. And Varys offers him a slightly different conversation. Again, we go back to the thought of Tyrion being a ruler. They're not going to say and speak of the futility of the world and this carriage crossing the east. They're going back. They're reverting to this conversation that Tyrion was quite fit to be a ruler, that Tyrion did a rather good job, even though he was a servant to the king, essentially. Yeah. He was a servant to his father's musings, essentially. Tyrion did a good job of taking care of business in King's Landing during a Clash of Kings. That was something we loved sharing with each other on the show here, chapter by chapter. That was something that we all enjoyed watching during season two. And I feel like we're getting that reminiscent quality where we're constantly referring back to it. And I feel like, guys, this is just more and more of Varys looking at Tyrion, and we're getting the sense of what he used to say before, but we're getting it out loud now. We're literally being told. And I feel like we're only maybe an episode or two away from Varys just all out being like, this is the X and Y of the Secret Society, or our council of people that are making these decisions, like we talked about last week. Mm-hmm. And we really think that you would be a great person inside of this, because you don't look like someone that a bunch of people would follow. You're not a tall, handsome, strapping lord that makes sense. You're not a Misa. You don't have dragons, but you do have a very, very sharp mind, and you're still a man of talent.
No, Varys does have a grand plan, and it's evident. I mean, I love our campfire discussion again, talking about who the other council members could be, what's their end game, do they have a backup, this, that, the other thing. Tyrion is clearly part of their plans, and that's probably directly due to the high regard that Varys has for him. But there's also the reveal of the plan, which is actually not to go directly to Meereen, but to Volantis. And I don't know what the hell it means, but Tyrion is just like, why aren't we going to Volantis? And he's like, or why aren't we going to Meereen? You said we were going to Meereen. What's in Volantis? And he says, that's the road to Meereen. And I don't know what that means, but clearly he's got a plan. Like, they have missions to go on. They have adventures that are very specifically located and a step. Varys clearly has a plan. This is Varys saying he has a plan. They're going to go one place and then go another.
Just for me, this scene, the dialogue between the two of them, there's so much to read into. And just the way these characters are written and the way that they talk to each other, the fact that they all feel protected inside this box because they don't want to be exposed to what's going on in the outside world. Mm-hmm. But then the reality that they're not satisfied being inside the box, and they're going down the road to Volantis inside of a box. And it's just a play on words, and you know that Varys has a master plan, to Eric's point. He's clearly cooking up something, and I always have a hard time deciphering his words because there's always a deeper meaning to what he's saying.
Definitely.
It's never just what he says is what you get. It's never taking it at face value. There's always something that the master whispers is up to.
These words are analogous, so I feel like we could lay down thing after thing after thing after thing, and he's implying all of these things at once, which I think is part of what makes this conversation so important. And I know that we'll dig into it deeper on our second episode this week, sort of like we did last week. But I'm really looking forward to hearing the thoughts of you guys, not only sending in your owns, but also just your thoughts in general of what all of this could mean. Because I don't know if this is part of the books. I don't know if that has been reached. I don't know if this is even how it's done. So without giving things away, when you're sending in your thoughts and questions, I'd just like to know. I'm curious as to how people feel about this, because I know how I feel, and I know that our conversations will reveal more between the three of us. But I'm curious to know how this was meant to be taken, how so much of this is meant to be taken, versus what we all kind of personally pull away from, because I feel like it's vague enough that we can have our own sort of personal conclusions, which is a very interesting way to take away from this.
I agree, and I am also interested to hear what the listeners think about these conversations, and both Sullied and Unsullied, knowing how things play themselves out with Tyrion. Is your perspective different? Are you okay with how things have been written for this season, and I'm fine with it so far. I'm not going to go into detail. I think we can probably talk more about that, because I don't think it's really, it's not spoilery necessarily. It's just, you know, similar to what I said earlier about Alaria and Arianne. So I think we can table that a little bit until later on in the week. But one scene that I found really, really amazing this episode was the small council that Cersei held.
Right. Or if she can hold a small council, it looks like she can't hold some of the members in there.
It's not appropriate for women to hold the title of Hand of the King. And what I took away from this scene now is that Cersei has sent two of her family members away from King's Landing, one directly, one indirectly. And I wonder if that's the smartest decision. Jaime's gone. He can't protect her from Dorne should anything happen. Kevin is now going back to Casterly Rock. He can't protect her should anything happen. Is she making the right decisions here?
Well, it's funny why, like, sort of looking at the reasons why she wants to send him away. He will not be brought to heel. He wants the king. He wants to hear the king's words. And that's the bottom line, is that she's speaking for the king. She's speaking out of turn. There's no way that Tommen said the things about all of those men, especially about Marjorie's father. Like, that's all crap. I don't think any of that was actually Tommen.
Right, but this is business as usual for the small council. These are how things are done, especially since Joffrey has been, and also King Robert didn't go to the meetings himself. I feel like before we had sort of Tywin's backing behind everything that's been said. So now his mm-hmm. brother's there sort of just looking at the situation and looking at Cersei right. and being like, well, there's no, you know, you are essentially the person making these decisions right now. And it was easy for me to follow my brother Tywin because he was Tywin Lannister, but you're just the queen mother.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He says, I did not return to the capital to serve as your puppet to stack the small council with sycophants.
See, he knows exactly who Cersei is, which is very interesting. It's very interesting getting that judgment from a relative of hers, because we found...
And what did he learn from his son?
Well, we basically find that...
That's true.
I think it's just interesting that you get a Lannister who isn't as gung-ho about every other Lannister just because they're a Lannister. Because Tywin was very close about his... Tywin reprimanded other Lannisters before and other generals in his army. But it's just interesting how forcefully Kevin speaks to Cersei about what he will and will not do. And it's really interesting that he does it in the group, not that she gives him much of a choice, but it's interesting to see that other Lannisters are turning their back on Cersei. As a matter of, I don't know if it's because she was incestuous, I don't know if it's because she slept with his son, as you mentioned, Micah, but I definitely think something's up, and it can't be good to see this Lannister walking away from the table. She should probably retain them.
Look what's happened so far. It's hard to stand idly and say that King's Landing has been handled and the Iron Throne has been handled well. We now have Tywin being killed by another Lannister. We've had a king be assassinated at his own wedding. We've had a king be killed during a boar hunt and be supplanted, essentially, by a bastard that is not his. It's just, as someone who is as wise as Tywin Lannister's brother, you know, and we're just zeroing in on this one situation. We have, obviously, Grandmaester Pycelle, who is aware. We have Mace Tyrell, who is happy to do whatever he needs to do. And we have Qyburn, who is getting what he wants and will ask no questions because his loyalty is going to go to the person that is essentially giving him what he wants. So it's like, if we zero in on this one person who's not hearing of it, I think that he's comfortable to do this because she's not in a place where she can exactly punish him because of who he is. And he can return to ruling Casterly Rock. You know, it's not like he needs to be in the middle of what's happening here. He can be completely against it and he can say no. He may be the master of war, but it does make sense for him to want to hear these things from the king. I think that the implications are very vast, and I think that it will be interesting to see how Cersei handles this, because she's not as aggressive as she could be or has been in the past, and I think that's because she doesn't have ground to stand on.
I think it's right for Micah to ask that question, because if Cersei's doing the right thing, because she is actually, not only is she alienating herself, but she won't reveal things to him, like when he asks about Jamie's mission and she doesn't tell him, and that's when he flips out. It's like he wants to give her a shot in a way. You know, it's like he just feels that if she's going to hide things from him, then she's very clearly the same Cersei that he has known, who uses puppets and uses sycophants, people who suck up to her, to do her bidding. And that's something that he won't be a part of. So that's great. But if she had just been a little bit more forthcoming or a little bit more outspoken about, well, why Jaime is leaving, just the topic at hand, instead of telling him that it wasn't his position, because she's acting out of her own, out of her position. So it's just like, oh, I'm done with you. I don't know. It was very bold for him to do that.
Well, I mean, it's clear that this is not the time for business as usual. Things have changed at the court, and things will need to change in the court for it to move forward. That much is clear.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to watch those small council meetings moving forward. And should Cersei decide to replace Kevin with a different master of war? We don't know. But I think it's a bad move on her part to be alienating members of her family, especially following the death of her father. And as we said after episode one, the vacuum that leaves in King's Landing, knowing how powerful and influential Tywin Lannister was to the overall Game of Thrones.
Oh, nicely done. Mm.
I think we're all in agreement here that one of the biggest scenes in this episode takes place, or series of scenes, I should say, at Castle Black. And I don't think we would be doing it justice by trying to squeeze it in here before the end of the episode. I think we do have another episode coming up later on in the week, and that will be the focus of that show, because I just think it's stacked with so many important moments, some that might bring you to tears.
Or some that might make you jump and
cheers.
Tear and have goose flesh. I can't handle it. I literally, the things that happened, more than one thing, which is excellent to be able to say. I've been holding it in this whole episode because we've been, we're talking about all the stuff that's happening. Sons of the Harpy, that's great. Brianna Pod, that's wonderful. But you all know Jon Snow elected Lord Commander of the Night's Watch. You all know Stannis Baratheon telling Jon to kneel and rise Jon Stark. Come on. Come on.
Well, I think you're forgetting that a certain wildling, a friend of ours, learned to read.
Yeah, Gilly's learning to read. I mean,
shit is happening at the wall.
Eric loves the tender moments.
I do love the tender moments.
Who taught you? Your mother? It's just full, and we're, I'm beyond excited to collect these owns and to collect just, I want to bottle the passion from all of you listening and keep it on a side table for moments of weakness and just know how everyone is feeling and feel how everyone is feeling after these moments that have finally been brought to us. And I'm going to be patiently waiting. I'm going to save everything. I'm going to treat my mind as a temple and consider our next conversation when we speak about the events at Castle Black as sacred.
Yes, they are.
They are.
Very sacred. It's just one of those sequences that you look back on and you realize how many important moments took place. And you touched on the two biggest ones, but even I'm thinking about the way that they craftily wove in the youngest daughter of Mage Mormont and what her name was.
Yes.
And how that was a nice little drop by the showrunners to basically have Olenna be responsible for Jon potentially rising as the Lord of Winterfell. Well done, David and Dan. I think that if you didn't catch that, it was intentional for sure.
Well, I'm just going to flat out say that my own of the episode absolutely, certainly, 100% goes to the 10-year-old Lady Lyanna Mormont for her handwritten letter Stannis Baratheon, to King Stannis Baratheon, saying,
"Dear Uncle Stannis,
yes, Bear Island knows no king but the king in the north, whose name is Stark."
Doesn't she draw a wolf?
Yes. Yes, she
doodled on their letter to the king. It's like writing to Santa Claus and drawing the cookies and milk.
The seed is strong on Bear Island, I just want to say, with no implications. Those are great people. Wonderful people.
As long as we're giving owns, I would stay in that same general geographic region.
Oh, damn.
No, and give it to one Maester Targaryen.
Yes.
At first,
yes.
I was like, is he counting the votes? Is this blind guy really counting the votes?
For casting the deciding vote in naming one Jon Snow Lord Commander of the Night's
yes.
Watch.
Yes. I really want to talk about it. I know we can't.
I do.
But,
I
want
to talk about
God.
It too.
What is your own? Come on, Eric.
My own is
stop holding out from London.
Look, my own is going to a 10-year-old girl. And
yes.
It's not Lyanna Mormont.
What?
It's going to Shireen Baratheon because she just taught another person who I didn't even like Gilly until she learned to read. She bettered herself, okay? And that is what this is all about. The slow game. People know how to read. Trump people don't know how to read all the time, just as evidenced by the people that we know who know how to read. And Shireen, maybe Maester Cressen, little own, mini own, because he clearly taught this little girl from an early age, from the age of 3, that sharing is caring. She's spreading the love, she's spreading the joy of reading, and it's super funny, that whole scene with her and how Sam kind of scoffs at it, or it doesn't scoff, but just they go back and
forth.
We're
not supposed to talk about it, Eric.
I know. But that's the
she's cock blocking him. That's what he's pissed off about.
Yeah, well, that's the own. So 10-year-old girl, definitely Shireen Baratheon. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of other owns, obviously, and we look forward to reading all of yours, the ones you come up with. Forward to talking about the wall on the next episode. But that's my own. I'm sticking to it.
I know that this isn't necessarily okay to do, but I also really wanted to give my own to Stannis for being the man that he is and doing the things that he did.
I'm sure he'll have plenty
you're allowed.
Of times. Plenty of times.
You too. Are allowed.
I know that they're streaming in. I look forward to reading those.
Plenty of owns have been sent to us on this second episode of Season 5 on Twitter, Facebook, email. We will compile them all and make them into one big pot of owns that we can, again, roast over the campfire.
With marshmallows.
And discuss.
I don't want to see one own to Arya for beheading that bird. I'm still going to be in mourning when we do the next episode.
You're a strange man, Eric Skull.
You really, really are.
God damn.
Don't want to see one. They showed the whole thing, at least with Cersei and the poor Tyrion lookalike's head. That was done off screen. But that bird man, just 1 second, his head was there, and the next second, there was blood. Mm-hmm.
Well, in case you've forgotten how to get in touch with us and send us your owns on Twitter, it's just at Game of Owns. Facebook, you can scroll upon our mini posts on our Facebook wall at facebook.com/GameOfOwns. Or email us, contact@GameOfOwns.com. We look forward to discussing and sharing all of your owns on the next episode as we dive deeper into what happened at Castle Black.
And thank you to the handful of new Patreon subscribers who have hopped aboard and are eagerly awaiting Chapter 6, which should release this week. So if you're interested in seeing all of the drama that will fall in that 6th chapter of the show we kind of release monthly, that's a bit insidery. And when I say a bit completely insidery, go to patreon.com/goo. Thank you.
And over on iTunes, we of course appreciate all the listeners that have gone over there and rated and reviewed the show as we head into this season. It is always great to have you tell others that, not the others, but just others in general, that we exist. So thank you so much for doing that. And of course, in the month of April, nothing less than 5 stars is acceptable.
This show wouldn't be what it is without you, without all of you writing in, without all of you making friends with one another, without all of you showing up at conventions and saying hello and really crafting the community around this show and around the books and around the HBO series. We know that this is a very, very popular show and that there are many options for what you're listening to, just considering the sheer popularity of it. And we thank you for joining the community, or even a community in general.
We thank you, of course, for listening to this episode. You, much like Drogon, we will return later on in the week.
With fire and blood.